Greta Thunberg and youth climate strike to the incredible Extinction Rebellion. Protest movements are back. All over the political spectrum, a huge sigh of relief could be heard. Finally, something else to talk about apart from Brexit. It goes without saying that climate change can't be solved on the national level. What better time then to have a European election, where the need for Europe to act urgently is more important than ever? On this episode of the Another Europe is Possible podcast, Zoe Williams and Luke Cooper are joined by MP Clive Lewis from the Labour Shadow Treasury team. Clive has been campaigning energetically for a Green New Deal to stop the climate catastrophe. To feed back to us on today's podcast, you can get us on Twitter at @another_Europe. And you can also get us at facebook.com/AnotherEuropeIsPossible. Hope you enjoy it.
Clive, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
As someone who's been working on the idea of the Green New Deal, you must have been really delighted by both Extinction Rebellion and the student climate change strike, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a duality to it because there is a sense that the mainstream political parties in Parliament really haven't grasped this in the way that they need to. I mean, I can sit here and pick fault with the Tories because they're the government. But I can also turn around to it and say that the Labour Party, and I think you speak to anyone on the shadow cabinet, we needed to have moved faster and speedier on this. I think change is coming. I think moves are coming. But when I saw it, there was a bit of me was like, oh, we could have been so much further on the front foot. Yeah. But we have made strides. I mean, if you think about it, one of the most successful parts of Jeremy's announcements at conference was, in fact, the, you know, the 400,000 green jobs in the renewable sector, renewable energy that he announced. So there has already been a sea change in terms of where the Labour Party, say, was and currently is, and it's only going to get better. But yes, I did welcome it, to cut a long story short.
I mean, you're calling for a climate emergency to be declared today.
I think, first of all, it opens up a debate here in Parliament about, it also calls out the Tories, the government, on how seriously they're taking this. I think there's a sense that they're talking the talk, but they're not walking the walk. And there's a sense, I think, a growing sense amongst the public that the government simply isn't doing enough. So by calling a climate emergency, you're going to separate the wood from the trees. Because the first thing to do, if your house is on fire, is to acknowledge that it's on fire so that you can then take the appropriate action, i.e. get up, start shouting and screaming and move out of the house to a safer place. That's basically what we want to see happen. So the first part in dealing with the implications of climate change is to acknowledge that we are facing a climate crisis. Why are we facing a climate crisis? Well, we've known for 25 years, or just over 25 years, since 1988, since the science was first put out there, that climate change is real and it's happening at a pace of knots. And yet within that time, we've put out more carbon into the atmosphere than throughout the rest of the industrialized period. So I think that kind of shows to people that we're not doing enough, that this is a climate emergency. We've got just over a decade to be able to make serious impacts, not just into decarbonisation, but also into biodiversity, into natural wildlife stocks. We've really, really got to kind of turn around how we view the economy, how it works, and put it on a sustainable footing. And I think that's in part what today will be about.
When you said we just then, you were kind of referring to the human species, in a sense, the whole global emissions, right? How do you deal with it as a development issue? Because so much of that increase has come through Chinese industrialisation. And I think that's a particular challenge for socialists, because basically Chinese people not being as poor as they were four decades ago is something that we would say is a good thing. So how do we link those?
So this is a really, really tough call. The first thing to do is to fess up and accept that the reason we're in this position is predominantly because of Western technological industrialization and advancement. We've reaped the main benefits and rewards of the last 200 or 300 years of industrialization. And in that time, we built up a fantastic empire, people would say, and got to industrialize first, created new markets and all that came with that. We'll just kind of put aside the kind of the two world wars and the wars of liberation that took place, the bloody wars of liberation that took place after that. But we've benefited humongously from that. And so this is about now saying, yes, it's right that the world's poorest some of them who will have to increase their consumption of carbon. If we look at what some people are consuming, it's simply not enough to exist on. But there's also going to have to be a contraction from the richer parts of the world. And we're also going to have to try and pioneer those technologies and the know-how about how we're going to change our economies. And actually, I would say share that with the developing world, not for profit necessarily all the time, but actually to help them play their part in being able to make the jump over the dirty period of their industrialization and development straight into a kind of clean, sustainable way forward. That's going to take from us, you know, as people who are kind of geared up to want to, you know, increase competitiveness and to corner the market, that's actually going to take a little bit of a different kind of worldview. Because if we don't do that, and if we do carry on with business as usual, then what you're going to see is that many parts of the developing world will say, we can't afford this. We're going to have to industrialise through that dirty stage if you're not prepared to share how that know-how with us. And that means that we're all going to suffer. So there's quite a bit of an egalitarian approach to this.
I suppose there is a really pressing thing here, right? Which is that if you're going to declare a climate emergency, or if you're going to commit to a Green New Deal, or if you're going to do both of those things as things that have to happen together, you can't really do this without international cooperation.
No.
It's a time in our lives when we need more and better and more widespread cooperation than we've ever had.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, we get into a philosophical realm here, because in many ways, you know, you read someone like James Martin and some of the other kind of futurologists who've talked about the 21st century, most scientists would agree with climate change, with nuclear proliferation, with biotechnology, with AI, with drones, we are making it, the way we currently configure ourselves, the way that international relations work, we're making it extremely unlikely, as things are, on the trajectories that we're on, that the human race will make it through the 21st century. The odds are stacked against us when you look at everything in the entirety of technology and so on. So in many ways, for us to kind of get through the 21st century and into the 22nd, there is going to have to be, if you want, a kind of a period of growing up. We're going through a kind of adolescence. We're going to have to grow up pretty quickly if we're to get through this period. And one of the tests, I think, if we do do it, when we look back on this, will be, can we work together as a global community? Because the technologies, because of climate change, these will have global impacts. If a nuclear bomb drops in the China Sea, that will have impacts across a vast swathe of the world. It isn't going to be confined to just one part of it. It could impact crop yields across the world, including in Europe. So we are interconnected. And I think our political and international structures and infrastructure haven't quite gripped that yet. And I don't think we're going to see it ourselves through into the 22nd century unless that happens.
Maybe we could ask you a little bit more to flesh out a bit the Green New Deal, because if we're talking about this as a huge global problem for everyone, with all of these inequalities between nations that are bundled up with it, then the conclusion would be, well, look, Westerners have to consume much less. Now, that's going to be electorally unpopular if it's very steep. But I guess the Green New Deal is a way of making this electorally popular. Is that how you see it? It's giving
so there's
people
a couple of,
there's, offer.
There's a couple of things here. First of all, I think there's increasing calls for, because of the scale of the changes that are going to be required. And it's not all about sacrifice. There are lots of opportunities here. I mean, everything from spending more time with your family and consuming more arts and culture, which are carbon light, have less impact on the ecology. There's lots of good benefits to this. There may be changes. They're not necessarily negative. I'm sure those who want to lock us into the high consumption, fossil fuel-led economy, I'm sure they will scream and kick and shout that this is going to be far worse. But actually, if we understand now that there are swathes of the planet, especially in the developing world, which are already being impacted by climate change, Mozambique, Bangladesh, islands that are disappearing under the Pacific Ocean, and that the next generation, as the youth climate strikers are already quite well aware in the Extinction Rebellion, are going to be handed no baton in terms of progress. In fact, will be regressing because of what we'll be handing to them in terms of the environmental destruction. Then I think you can begin to have a conversation with people now to say, how do we stop this? And one of the things that people are increasingly calling for is what's called deliberative democracy through people's assembly. For people to come together across the political spectrum, to sit down, to listen to experts, to listen to what's possible on both sides of the argument and what isn't, and then for people to say, actually, to buy into the decision-making processes. Now, politicians can then say, OK, people have actually... This is what never happened in Brexit. We've seen what happens on the Good Friday Agreement when deliberative democracy is used, on abortion in Ireland. Deliberative democracy is something I think a lot of people, especially after the experience of Brexit, are open to. I think that can get buy-in. But I think the key thing, really, from politicians is that if we listen to the science, then the science is telling us we're talking about decades now, one decade, really, to be able to get our house in order. That means if we started that 20 years ago, it could have been far more incremental. We missed that boat. So that means that the challenges now ahead of us mean they're going to be deeper, they're going to be more profound, but it's opportunities, not just sacrifices. I think that's an important way of trying to convey that to people.
I mean, realistically, do you feel like we could go carbon neutral within a decade?
The Extinction Rebellion is calling it by 2025. I think given where we are, given that we have a government that really isn't shifting on this in the way that it needs to, who is in denial in some ways about the climate emergency that confronts us in this country, I think that would be extremely difficult. It's not impossible, but I think the level of change, if we take, you know, almost 30-40% of that time up with the Conservative administration going full term. it becomes almost impossible, even if you throw everything at it.
Oh, it's completely impossible.
But I think, as you know, look, you know, 2025, aim for the stars, you might reach the sky. We're talking a decade, and I think the changes that are going to be required mean that we're going to have to confront the kind of, if I can use this word on your program, I'm sure I can, that neoliberal idea of what's possible and what's not is definitely going to have to be confronted, that markets are the only vehicles that have the solutions, that there's no role for the government or a minimal role for the government, that regulation has no part to play. These are all things which I think now are not only being challenged, I think the public is shifting on this. And the Green New Deal has been around for a long time. It's been around for about 10 years. It's an idea that was before its time. I think now it's an idea that people understand is an idea whose time has arrived. And let's be clear here, it isn't just about renewable energy. It's also about a complete sea change in the deal that all of us have. Those people who perhaps voted Brexit in the industrial wastelands of this country, who feel that they have no stake in the future. The Green New Deal isn't just about saying, well, hey, we're going to produce some new energy jobs. It's about a complete new deal about education, training, about the facilities that you have, about access to education, health. It's a complete package. That's what's so attractive about it. It's a new deal for our democracy. And I think that's what's so exciting about it.
Let me ask an Aggie question on this. Caroline Lucas very recently argued in The Independent, Green New Deal, great that Labour are getting on board with it.
Well, we call it a green industrial revolution. But I mean, at the end of the day, we all know where we're all heading on this. So yeah.
So why did the Labour Council in Cumbria back a new open cast coal mine? Because she basically turns around, big supporter of Another Europe, so it's a plant basically. She turns around and says, look, great that on the national policy, but what are you doing in Cumbria?
I think the question that she's thrown up there is why I believe the Labour Party is best placed to be able to deal with this, which may sound kind of contradictory given that a Labour administration has just announced the opening of that coal mine. Whatever the changes that are going to take place, those with the least within our society are going to have to come first in terms of where that resource is going to be distributed. Because as we've seen in France, and the Gilets Jaunes campaign that's taking place over their protests, if you get that wrong, you lose popular support. And with a democracy, that's fatal. So what I would say is the reason that Labour administration has opened that coal mine is because of the hundreds of relatively well-paid, secure jobs that will come from it. In an area where the gig economy is ascendant, is king, those jobs mean so much for those quite literally impoverished communities. So what I would say is don't blame that Labour administration for taking a decision. The cash-strapped Labour administration that can see hundreds of jobs in its community, I can understand why they're doing that. So what we have to offer, what government has to offer, is to say that there is an alternative clean strategy and we will be funding that to make sure that the choices that you have are clean choices, not dirty choices, not coal, not looking backwards into the 20th and 19th century, into the 21st century. But whilst we have austerity in full flow, whilst we have the gig economy in full flow, I can empathise with why that Labour Council is doing that. That's what we have to change. But they have no incentive to change because they can see no other alternative. So, you know, I understand Caroline's criticism. I can criticise it as well. But what we need is a just transition to a clean future. And that's why the Labour, I think the Labour movement and the Labour Party are well placed to do this, because we understand this isn't going to work. And there's working class people in this country, the working people of this country are given those opportunities to be able to make that clean transition, which at the moment isn't there.
I think the problem is, and I mean, I sort of feel like there's no point levelling anything at a local council when we've had this terrible government and nobody's got any money for the past 10 years. There's no point. Exactly the same thing was levelled at Brighton Council, and it was like, you're meant to be so green and look at your bins, and that was a pay dispute.
I was gonna tweet that, but, you know, but I didn't.
I just find it, and this, I think, comes into the transition to a just and green economy, is that we have to transition into a just and kind of slightly less dumb politics, because we all know what the pressures are, and we all know what an easy point is and what a cheap point is, and these are really obvious things, but even the best of us still get wrong-footed.
And
by
the debate's happening all over Europe as well. In Poland, there's a big debate over the future of the coal mining industry there, and the new sort of centre-left, maybe centre-liberal party is leading on closing down all of the coal mines, because they're really appealing to the young, university-educated population, and they see it as an electoral winner. But when I was there, I was saying to them, yeah, but you've also got to think about the workers in the coal mines. So what's your 100% strategy for redeveloping those industrial areas?
It's exactly the same as the anti-fracking movement, right? The thing is, if you're going to use gas, then you should frack your own land, because the alternative is you're going to buy it from somewhere else that's fracking their land. And there's no justice in that either. I mean, I'm really against getting mired in this kind of, oh, we're 5% better than you, which I think is a real pitfall for the green on red stuff.
I think the whole point about just transition is that you can't have a just transition from an unjust economic model which has record levels of inequality, which is raping the planet quite literally, destroying the planet quite literally as an economic system and model, and then have a just transition into a slightly improved corporate-led clean energy revolution. I mean, ultimately, to have a just transition, you need to have those communities who are going to be most affected by the transition front and centre, those who are least able and least capable of making the jump and transition to clean energy, given the biggest amounts of support, and also ensure that that new energy model, that new kind of energy net, those energy networks, not only sustainable, but are community owned or publicly owned, and that people have a real say and a real stake in that future. We want to move away from the kind of big national corporate-owned networks. The future is resilient, it's local, it's devolved, and it's giving powers to individuals and, well, communities, to be quite frank. And I think there's no point us kind of making the transition to kind of clean energy if we're simply going to hand it over to big corporate interests who are going to continue in other ways screwing us all over, you know. And I think that's where Labour comes from, and I think that's one of the things that we bring to the table.
Obviously, we've got European elections coming up now. And how would you upscale some of these policies to the European level? I mean, the European Union has fantastic climate goals. Yeah. I think we were talking earlier about whether you can move to carbon neutral economies and in what time scale. I mean, the European Union aims for mid-century, which is a pretty realistic goal, I think, but is still incredibly ambitious and not the direction of development at the moment. What are we saying in the European elections, and how do we actually get the regional organisations working with the national organisations to get the politics right?
So I would say there's a democratic deficit, and we talked about limited democracy. There's going to have to be a kind of, one of the things about Europe, and I'm assuming we're still going to be in it, one of the things that we have to rectify is how decisions are made in the European Union and under whose interests. I think that's been clear. You know, I'm from a group politically who thinks that one of the best ways of tackling climate change at an international level, whether that's on climate change, tax avoidance, taking on the big digital companies, the big tech companies, is by working together in Europe. But the democracy of Europe needs to be revamped if we're to have buy-in from across Europe in these quite radical programs. I think the finance aspect, how are we going to fund this? You know, the European Central Bank, nation state central banks are going to have to work together to make sure that we can raise the kind of the $6 to $8 trillion dollars a year that the global economy needs to raise to be able to decarbonize at the scale that the IPCC has said will keep us under 1.5 degrees. So there's something there about what reform are we going to make to the financial institutions and structures within the European Union. And then I think the other part that I would look at is, I suppose if you've got the democracy and the finance of it, you have to look at the other part of it, which is, I think, the agricultural stroke biodiversity component. And I think sometimes that kind of gets forgotten. We kind of focus a lot on the kind of shiny renewable energy side of things. But what we know from the science is on biodiversity issues, you look at Germany, probably one of the most advanced countries when it comes to renewables, and yet it's seen some of the biggest declines in its insect populations Europe. So, you know, there's no way you can decarbonize, replenish natural capital stocks. For want of a better word, I'm going to use that because I think what most people understand, carbon sinks and all the other things that go ahead with that, unless we can get the other side of the coin sorted out as well, which is that. And so that means a complete review of things like CAP. You know, at the moment, how do we get those to interlock and to work with the Natural Habitats Directive, with the EU Water Directive? How do we ensure that we're put on a sustainable footing? At the moment, we have an agricultural system which pays lots of money to very wealthy landowners. And the incentive there was originally to make sure that Europe never had a shortage of food. Well, food security needs to still be a part of that. But we're not going to have food security if we have collapsing ecosystems across Europe in the next 10 or 20 years, which is what the science is saying potentially could happen. It is entirely possible that we begin to solve the problems of climate change and still kid ourselves through a number of other balancing boundaries which are being crossed over at the moment. So the other side of the coin from clean energy is the ecological farming, agricultural, biodiversity side. And that's the other kind of part to this that we need to kind of keep in mind.
There's something I find quite interesting about Europe, which is that, you know, we all broadly agree that it had 30 years going in a basically Thatcherite direction, not least because Thatcher was kind of exerting a major influence on its kind of DNA. But it did manage with the environmental stuff to keep this very pro-social sort of non-corporate side of itself. And it did manage, as you say, to make fantastic targets. And it did actually do some fantastic stuff. Even if the only thing we can remember is clean beaches, it did do some fantastic stuff. So how was it that they were able to sidestep the political direction of their own institutions and maintain this kind of safe green space for themselves?
I mean, it's ridiculed as technocracy, isn't it? But I think experts matter in the European Union, so that is a factor. Yeah. I mean,
it's one of the upsides of a lack of democracy, I suppose, in having a technocratic system. How do you keep the respect for experts, but ensure that they're not simply running the roost, because they can make some good decisions, but they can also make some poor ones when it comes to the economy and Greece.
A lot of the best proposals for reforming Europe come out of the European Commission. So say on 2012, the European Commission produced a paper on fixing the Eurozone that said three things. We need a Eurozone budget, so we need fiscal union. We need debt mutualisation, so it shouldn't be any more expensive to borrow in Germany than it is in Greece. And you need complete monetary and banking union. It came from the European Commission.
Yeah, I would say that just because something isn't democratic doesn't mean it's incapable.
It's bad.
I think it is in some ways,
but I think we can agree that there is one of the kind of big reasons why we're in the mess we are across Europe is because sometimes decisions have been taken which don't seem to reflect, I think, the will of the vast majority. I don't think the vast majority, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think the vast majority of people would have wanted the banks and the EU to treat Greece as it did. I don't think the vast majority of people in the European Union would agree with the kind of brutal Fortress Europe approach that we take. So I think there can be good things that can come from a technocratic EU commission. There are. But what we want to do is keep the good bits that the experts give and the technocrats are able to provide, but yoke it to enhance democracy. And that way you can hopefully get the best of both worlds. And also as well, we can take ownership for some of the decisions that are made. If someone else is making decisions on your behalf, if they work, then great. But if they don't, then you see the implications. And we're seeing that now on the Brexit debate. So I think if people feel that they actually have a democratic say and a voice and can directly see how they're engaging in that, and some of that is political education, ultimately the decisions that are made, and some of them will be tough in the future when it comes to climate change and biodiversity issues, people have a sense of ownership of.
Yeah,
Moving a little bit away from the climate change issue, but more into the messy world that we always talk about on this show, Brexit and Europe and everything. Mm-hmm. The European elections always presented as a problem, always presented certainly by the Tories, and you can see it's a problem. They're collapsing in the polls and the rise of the Brexit Party. But I dare say even on the Labour side, there's a reluctance or disappointment that the European elections is a hit, something that they maybe didn't want for, amongst some people. Couldn't you also see it as a great opportunity to go out there and trailblaze on a series of issues like European Green New Deal that we've been talking about?
Look, I think if you're of a mindset where you want to move away from the European Union in some way, just at the time that, you know, the climate crisis, the rise of large corporate entities, digital companies, tech companies, just at the moment that you actually need, in many ways, closer cooperation. If you think it's a good idea to move away into a customs union and so on, you probably would have seen the EU elections as a bad thing, because in some ways it allows a platform for people to articulate what Europe has done well and could do better. And you don't want that, because you don't want to remind people of what they're leaving. You just want to get on with it. And so I understand that. And of course, there are some on the left who actually see the EU as the political wing of NATO. And it's a, you know, it's a neoliberal entity. We have to get out of it, so on and so forth. Well, they wouldn't want it either. But I think there's the vast majority of Labour members and voters, and if you look at the polling on that, it agrees with it, would see these elections as a potential opportunity to remind people what the European Union is capable of, what a kind of transformed, reformed EU is capable of.
But can you imagine that? Because I've never known a European election fought on Europe. It's always been a kind of ventriloquised debate about domestic politics. It's never been about the European Union.
I agree with you, but ultimately now I would say we're in a unique position where this isn't business as usual.
Let's bloody hope so.
And so what, you know, what we should be doing as a party is saying, listen, let's park the PV. I mean, I personally think that having a final say on whatever deal goes through in the manifesto just sorts out so many problems. It's an opportunity for Labour to do really well, to beat the Brexit Party, to show that we can beat them, and to give a massive fillip to Labour's economic programme, its social programme, to build on that 2017 manifesto. It's a massively brilliant platform for that. We can just segue away from the in-out, shake it all about, PV, no PV debate, and we can then start to talk about what I think everyone in Labour wants to talk about, which is our domestic policies, our Green New Deal, our Green Industrialisation programme, what we're going to do on public ownership, what we're going to do in terms of changing the economy so that it works for the many, not the few, what we're going to do to NHS, the National Education Service. Start talking about what it will mean if you vote for Labour at these European elections. This, in a way, is a dry run for the next general election, and we can begin to say to people, this is what Labour are going to do. This is how we're going to change your lives, your children's lives, your community lives. That's the opportunity this represents. Instead, unfortunately, we're spending that time bickering about a PV.
So yesterday's NEC, it's a fudge, isn't it, what we're saying?
If the party isn't coming out and saying it's pro-PV or anti-PV, I think we're free to take that as a pro-PV message.
Well, we will. But the problem is we will open ourselves up to the valid criticism from Chuck, from the Lib Dems, from the Greens, that actually a vote for Labour, no matter what the candidate says to you, no matter what those MPs supporting a PV say, the actual party leadership is opposed to that. And ultimately, that costs you at the ballot box, you know?
For sure.
That's the problem of a fudge. It basically means it's what we've had for the last however long. You know, it does hold the coalition together, but you begin to kind of basically flake off quite large amounts of support, enough to make a viable difference to whether you have X many MEPs or an enhanced amount of MEPs. And that's not good. You know, if we come a percentage point, 2%, 3%, 5%, 6% behind the Brexit Party, it doesn't make a difference whether it's 1%, 0.5% or 6%. We've lost to the far right. That's not good. And that's not a good way to go into the next 3 years talking about the Labour project. Yeah. It really isn't. We've lost to the far right. They will have the initiative. That's not a good place to be.
Thanks to Clive and thanks to you for listening. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. You can find a full back catalogue of podcasts on www.anothereurope.org, where you can also join the campaign. And you can follow us on Twitter at @another_Europe. We'll be back very soon. See you then.